I don't know what I'm doing up here on this occasion. Is it question time or what?
You know something about Christmas.
My friend Gerhardt has hired himself away to a safe distance. Not from me, from this terrible fellow on the front row. Dark night of the soil. Or the soil. I don't need to think to talk about those, do I?
Would you also add something about this word camels from the Norwegian land?
What's that mean, Hemi? Tossing Norwegian terms about?
I thought you might be able to tell us something
about it. Why?
I think it's linked to Christmas time and to a thing called collectibanks.
Collectibanks?
Yes.
Would you have not preferred it in Swahili?
English,
but it's all based on a very simple fact of the cycle of the year. I'm not getting any squeaks in my ears, so I can't be overmodulated, David. Why is that? I usually have squeaks in the ear, which is unbearable. That's better. It's a question of voluntary self-sacrifice to the cause. Let's just think about ourselves before civilization got hold of us. Let's go back a few million years to when our first humanoid ancestors existed, and they had not at that time fabricated mathematics. You know that the Babylonians had mathematics, and so did the Egyptians, and the Greeks, and the Hindus, and David Adams. And actually it was Abraham who converted Babylonian astronomical mathematics into good business, hence the prophecy about his derivatives. But before the fabrication of a system of terminology about the year, imagine what it was like to a people with no vocabulary beyond grunts, barks, hisses, growls, very limited, and they were presented with a peculiar series of events, and they hadn't got any terms to nail the events down. So they had no term spring, summer, autumn, winter, and spring again. Nobody had yet invented the lovely little proverb, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? For many thousands of years, there had to be observations before certain advanced thinkers came to the conclusion that there was really a cycle of events that would repeat itself more or less identically. And this cycle of events they called the year. Now there were two ways of reckoning this year, which were in conflict, and one was reckoning by the moon, and the other was reckoning by the sun. Now, in the northern hemisphere, we see that when we face south, the sun rises in the east. As the poet Omar said, dreaming when dawn's left hand is in the sky. If you face south, which is over there, the sun rises on your left hand. And at this time of the year, it is a very low level. On the 21st of our calendar, 21st of December, the sun hits its lowest level. If we go further up into the Arctic Circle and beyond, the sun will actually roll around the horizon. And, you know, there's a story in the Bible about Joshua fighting a battle and commanding the sun to stop till the battle was finished. The suggestion made by good scholars is that he must have taken them on a foray very far north to where the sun actually did not sink, and fought the battle there, and then came back with his army telling the wonderful story about how Joshua stopped the sun going down. In those northern latitudes, they have a very peculiar disease, the one that Herbie's referred to, a dreadful angst. The English word is anxiety. I'll translate the word angst into its phonetics for you. An means a serpent, and that serpent means sensuality, enjoyment. The hard G, the ga in angst, that hard G means compaction of the earth. S means self-issuance, and T means crucifixion. So the word angst actually means that sensuality has got itself brought down to the lowest level of existence in the gross material world and is there crucified and may never rise again. Now the primitive people, before the calendar was fabricated, used to view with very, very great alarm this period we call the winter solstice. Solstice meaning when the sun, the solo, stands still, or apparently stands still in the sky. For us in our calendar, that is the 21st. On that day, the sun has hit its lowest point and it appears to stand still. There was tremendous anxiety in the primitive mind of humankind in case the sun never rose again. It might possibly, in its downgoing, approaching the winter solstice, it might go down and disappear below the horizon and never come up again. And people were genuinely fearful of that possibility. Now in the Scandinavian countries, the same anxiety still exists today. They have a very peculiarly long winter when the sun is very low, and they have very, very low energy level, like we do before Christmas, hence our pre-Christmas quarrelling, which merely means that the energy of self-control is deficient. When these people experience this terror that the sun might not rise again, they entered into deep gloom, a deep gloom that affects the Scandinavian peoples today, just like it did for their ancestors. And in the ancient world, the first of the astronomers who discovered this cycle were also elevated by their knowledge to the level of king priests or priest kings. They had the knowledge. Kennen, to know in German, König, the king, Können, to be able. So with Können and Kennen, to be able to know, a man was king, but he was also priest, because he knew about this cycle of the year. And in the Scandinavian countries, when the sun began to fall down and this dreadful melancholy fell upon the people, then the priests used to wait. And then about 40 days before the solstice, they used to go up into the mountains, having told the people, we will go and conjure the sun god. And they went up into the mountains and they watched very carefully, and they made measurements using mountain tips and crevices between mountains, rather like this coordinative diagram behind us, which is the other meaning that David was about to refer to. At Stonehenge you have a similar device. You have an arrangement of stones which enables you to measure the year by standing in a certain position using a stone as a marker, and the sun's light will fall between two stones at a certain time of the year, and you will be able to know then when the sun is going to start to rise again. So on that blackest of all days, the 21st of December, when the energy was very low and people were very melancholy, you probably felt it yourselves in the last few weeks, a deadening of your responses. Have you felt tireder than usual? Have you felt gloomier than usual? Most people do. And a lot of people die at this time of the year, more than in the best days of summer, because this dreadful melancholy comes down and makes you wonder what you're living for. Because if the sun goes away completely, all life on earth will die. So therefore, the best thing to do is devise a method of causing the sun god to rise. And this the priest kings of the ancient world promised the people they would do. And they went up into the mountains and they studied their mountain markers and they waited. On the 21st, it had hit its lowest point. They knew that on the 25th, the light would obviously begin to rise again. That heavenly globe would be a little higher than it was on the 21st. Now, there's no mention in the Bible about the actual birth date for Jesus, and its date was fixed on the 25th of December by a monkish astrologer, precisely because that was the first day after that darkest day of the solstice, where the sun was obviously going to rise again. So that 25th became the symbol, really, of the beginning of the resurrection. The same day in the year was the birth date of Zarathustra in ancient Persia. Now imagine that prophet long ago, his name is Golden Star, which is the name of the sun. And when the three Magi, Magi, as the anglicized form goes, the three astronomer magicians were examining the sky, they looked for a certain configuration of stars. We can do it by looking at the plough. Very simply, that group of stars we call the plough is a kind of clock that tells us the time of the year. Now, he was a great man in his day, about the 6th century BC. He was treated in the same way as Jesus for the same reasons by the government of his day, because he was enlightening people by telling them about this yearly repetitive cycle which would remove the anxiety of people by promising them the resurrection. Now, it is the grossest material fact to us that we stand on the earth and we can verify like this. The resistance convinces us there is something firm on which to stand. But the gross material world can be destroyed. We know that today by nuclear weapons. You can take matter and you can reduce matter. In the ancient world, it was a tremendous relief to people to think that there was a cycle, that the cycle would repeat endlessly. They would always know that if the sun sank, it would rise again. And that was the grossest material aspect. But the more intelligent of the priest-kings said, why should we depend on a gross material thing if we can take a hammer and smash a rock? Is there not something stronger than the rock we can smash with our hammer? So they began to think, and they thought up something that was absolutely invariable and very dear to David's heart, I mean, of course, David Adams, namely pi ratio. Now, the thing about pi ratio, and I appeal to David, what is it, David? Is it permanent?
Yes.
Permanent. It's called an irrational because, having worked out its number of decimals to about 500, they got fed up. But it is the ratio of the diameter to the circumference of a circle. And this ratio works for all circles regardless of size. So it doesn't matter whether you're a little fellow or a big fellow. You start as an egg, which is a sphere, and the diameter and the circumference are related in a way that is eternally fixed, utterly beyond argument. So that although you may take a physical gross rock and break it with a hammer, you cannot, with a hammer, break pi ratio. Pi ratio, therefore, became the permanent reference for the priest-kings. Now imagine that there's something inside your mind stronger infinitely than a most solid rock that you could strike with a hammer. Something that will never let you down, and which your consciousness can focus upon and say, this rock is the rock of eternity. You get it in religious term, the rock of ages, the rock of all ages, the rock that will never be broken. And there's a lot of planning going on about this mysterious rock. The rock, the ROCK, that we use for building upon instead of sand, that rock, that base salt, that saturnine compression, eventually will be ground down and will be smashed. The whole material world will undoubtedly be smashed at some period in the future, not merely by nuclear weapons, which will only smash bits of it. It will be smashed by the logical necessities of precipitation, because precipitation and deprecipitation. The centripetal and centrifugal forces alternate. If there is compression, there is decompression, and they are cyclic. Someday, the gross material world will vanish. It will be reduced to dust. The astronomers have tried to frighten people in the last 100 years about what they call the heat death, thalia, the flattening of all the energies in the world, the going cold of the sun, the vanishing of life, and then eternal stillness. Well, that was a piece of frightening, imaginative effort to scare people out of their wits. It is no longer currently held by the astronomers that held it 50 years ago. It has been exploded. And rather something else, an oscillation of movement to the center, a movement away from the center and back to the center, and so an eternal oscillation. Now this oscillation is an oscillation of power. In the little verse about beware of this little baby with his pink flesh, the reason I said there, you have to watch him, because he represents, he is the personification of pi ratio. He is the embodiment of this unshakable reason. And the word rock in English, and the rook in a game of chess, and the rook of the Arabs, and the rook of the Hebrews, are all the same word. Now, supposing we take this word rock, and we aspirate the K and say roch, and then we turn the word round, reverse it, we have a word hor. You can see it in English in the word chorus, ch, for one letter, as in Scottish loch. That ch represents one letter, the eighth letter of the alphabet, which in the Hebrew is a chet, or a ches, if you're an Ashkenazi. Now, that sound of ch means controlled effort and secreted power, and followed by the letter R, which means to differentiate and to discriminate, it means itself hierarchy. In ancient Egypt, it was called chorus, a hawk flying in the sky. It is the origin of our word hour, so many hours of the day, and the Greek chorus, and the Egyptian chorus, and our chorus of today are all the same word, and they all refer to a hierarchy of powers. Now, all power is of the infinite, but the infinite itself cannot manifest without self-condensation. It precipitates within itself, by its own will, a point of reference. And this point, if we represent it phonetically with the dot on the letter I, and we prefix it with this C, this letter chet, followed by an I, we would write it in English H-I, pronounce it he, and it's Hebrew for she. So that when you say she in that way, in Hebrew you are saying she. Now she is the rock of ages. And yet this title belongs to Christ. And yet the peculiar letter of life, which is hey, not secret, which is hey, which is life itself, the fifth letter, that life is a power that's absolutely free, and the same power, when it gets hold of itself, turns from hate to chet. It fixates itself and becomes a powerful center of reference. It is that chor, which is this rock, which is the rock of ages, which is this unbreakable concept. Now, what is a concept? Some people might think merely an idea. Now you know that the critics of the primitive mind have said the primitive mind personalized nature forces and thought it saw in the wind, the storm, the volcanic eruption, the earthquake, all calamities. They thought the primitive mind believed that they were produced, all these actions, all these events, produced by spirits. On the analogy that when a man wants to do something, he himself wills to do it. He thinks about it and he does it. As far as man knows, by his own personal actions, he is the precipitator of his own actions. And when he looked around him in the universe, He thought that everything was produced in exactly the same way in nature that he produced his own action. He knew that when he ate food, he grew by his will, and that he piloted his own body, his own organs, his own eyes, by his own will, to be precisely that which he publishes. And therefore, he said, likewise, the wind, it is a spirit that is blowing willfully, and the mountain that explodes, the volcano, called Cyclops by the ancients, he of the one eye, the volcano seen from above, that he was really a spiritual, intelligent power, and that this power was blowing up, just like a human being in a bad temper. And the critics say the primitive mind was very foolish in personifying natural forces. Now, it is elementary, basic logic that if you say that the primitives were wrong, you have to explain how the moderns are right. Now, in actual fact, logically, if we were to say the reverse and say, if man has the power to personify nature's forces, and we examine the origin of man, we have to say that man is himself an effect of nature's forces, that somehow nature's forces have come in and condensed in man. And it's just as valid in logic to say, not that man has personified natural forces, but that natural forces have precipitated man. Now, is there a logician in the house that could disagree with that? If man is intelligent, if the anthropologist says to the primitive, oh, he believed that nature forces are persons, is he not forced to say that man's personal attitude is nothing but an evolution to the forces of the universe that were there and precipitated in the evolutionary process man, able to make this remark? Man is the product of spiritual forces. The primitive mind was not wrong. What happened was, at a certain date, which we would call loosely the Renaissance, people became horribly materialistic. They threw out the original Greek meaning of the word physics, which meant living studies, studies of living things, and made it mean studies of non-living things. But that didn't happen until a certain period in history. We get the first shadows of it with Roger Bacon, and then we get it formulated with Francis Bacon some time later, and we get a materialistic attitude that pretends that the universe is material, and that somehow the behavior of the matter produced in the highest form thought in man, and feeling in man, and will in man. So all these non-personalized forces of nature somehow mysteriously produce man, able to think and feel and will. And that's just as weird as saying that the primitive man personified the wind. We have to say, man himself, as we know him, able to think and feel and will now, according to the evolutionists, is a product of natural forces, which have somehow, by cohering and condensing into man, have made of man that peculiar being with a sense of hierarchy. He is a horror. He is condensed hierarchical power. Infinity has come down and posited the individual man. And therefore, man can think and feel and will, because thinking and feeling and willing are inherent in the very powers of the universe before the planetary system is even evolved. They're there waiting to condense, and gradually they become the human being. Now, it took a long time, many, 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 many centuries, for the thinkers to get together and say this wonderful thing: someday there will arise a man who will actually know in a reflexive way his source, that the universal power which is condensing in the involutionary process that makes man, that power is condensing and producing in each individual human being a being who is a precipitative spirit. He is literally a god. Remember when accused of blasphemy for likening himself to God, Jesus replied, "Is it not written in your scriptures, ye are gods?" Every individual who reflexively becomes able to think, feel, and will deliberately is a god. He defines his own good. Now, when this force of infinity comes in, we call this the creative process. To create is to encapsulate, to arc, to close, to finite. Infinity has posited this finite being, the individual human being. And when he is closed down in this way, he is solo. He is soul. He is himself, his own sun. And you know, the astronomers will tell you that the sun in the sky radiates light because of tremendous pressures inside it. Is that not so? The tremendous pressures inside the solar orb in the sky, pressing upon it, squirt out from it photons, particles of light, only by the pressure. In the same way, from infinity, moving into the human being, infinite pressures bearing on man force him into an encapsulated condition, and then working upon him, compress him until he internally is completely crucified. And he is literally locked in and dead. And that death corresponds with the 21st of December. That is the winter solstice. That's when the solar being is standing in itself, frozen in the ground. We have pretty good example at the moment in our recent weather conditions of what it is like. Something that was fluid, heated by the sun, rose and became a vapor, went up, became clouds, comes down in the form of rain, comes down colder still, snow, hail, falls on the earth, covers it up, and then hardens. Imagine a human individual being hammered from the eternal to the infinite, hammered onto his own center, and forced by that hammering to individuate. Now, individuate means to be put into a state of individuation, divided from other beings. All the bodies in this room are divided from each other for one very simple reason. Infinity eternity is compressing itself onto everybody as a point of reference. Every single one of us is a point of reference for the eternal Ruach, spirit, the infinite intelligent power. And when we are compressed down until we are totally incapable of movement, that is our 21st of December. That is our winter solstice. That is our great death. Now, if we do not die, we cannot resurrect. We can't have a spring unless we have a winter. If we look at that word Christ, and it's a mysterious word, they say, well, that wasn't exactly the word. There was a word in Greek, Christos, but it wasn't Christos. But in fact, throw out the vowels and you have H-R-S-T, don't you? The crust. The crust of the earth has dropped its H, hardened, lost its manifest power. But this word Christ is made up of the word for a circle, which in modern German is Christ, plus T, which means a cross, so that when you say Christ, you've actually said circle with a cross in it. And you know this circle with a cross in it, if you remember your physics and the rules of crystallization, if you get a saturated fluid, take a simple one like water with salt in it, and you add more salt very carefully, at a certain point you will overload it and suddenly a crystal will appear in it, and that crystal will begin to accrete to it. Now every human being is made in exactly the same way. Forces from infinity have come in, have compressed it, and it does not like being compressed. It likes pleasure. It does not like crucifixion. But if it doesn't get itself crucified, crystallized, made into a crystalline form, it can never become to itself the Jerusalem. That Jerusalem is the city of peace. Every individual, to become at peace with himself, must first accept that he is posited there by the infinite and is crucified until he gives in. As long as you think you can get away with it and you don't give in, You're not crystallized. You're still fooling about in your fluids. And fluid is the symbol of sensuality. But when you get nailed on the crystalline structure, you have been nailed on solid logic, pi logic, pi ratio. The par pi rus, the name of the paper, our word paper derives from it, in the Egyptian, where Moses went to school, where Jesus went to school, where Joseph was master of the corn, where Abraham went to get his first fortune from a misguided Pharaoh. In those schools of mystery was this great secret taught, the thing that is stabilizing for all beings, if they can grasp it, is not the gross material rock that can be smashed with a hammer, but the rock which is ultimate logic, called the logos. The rock that says there is no finite individuated body that is not an infinite spirit intending to posit that body. When we identify with the body, and we feel lonely, and we feel deserted, and we feel cold, and we feel unhappy, that's our 21st of December. That is our solstice. But if we remember, if winter comes, can spring be far behind, we can escape that Scandinavian anxiety, that dreadful angst, that sense that our am, the sensual serpent, compacted in the ground of our own being, self-crucified by the intent of the infinite to posit gods. If we can accept this fact and sit in the middle of our total dejection, which in another terminology is called the dark night of the soul, at the point where we're absolutely certain that we cannot do anything from our empirical egotistic point of view, that we are utterly powerless and we are in the grip of this tremendous power of the universe. And the name of that grip, in astronomical terminology, is Saturn. Now Saturn is S-T-U-R-N, and it means the self-crucified being that is himself a power which through his own differences has negated himself. Saturn means self-crucified, phallic power, discriminating, looking for its pleasures, and because of the excessive complication of its pleasure pursuit, refuting itself. That's the terminal N in the Saturn. Saturn is the ruler of winter. And the 21st of the December is the supreme day of the triumph of Saturn, who is Satan, self-crucified serpent, sensuality, self-crucified. Now this is very interesting because you can't stop people chasing pleasure. Until they get nailed by events, they will chase this ridiculous ignis fatuus, this will-o'-the-wisp. They will think that pleasure is something outside you, and that you need to get an object to get pleasure out of the object. It is a total self-deceit, and it's a very passive, negative concept. There's another word, happiness, which is far greater than pleasure, because pleasure means you are passive to the stimulating object. You are at the mercy of the object. If you define an external object as the source of your pleasure, one day that object will be taken away from you. And then you will be miserable. But supposing you say, I have no pleasure pursuit. You know, one cannot be a yogi if one pursues pleasure. What I want is absolute happiness. Now, our word happy is just the same, with a slight spelling difference, as the Egyptian, happy, H-A-P-I. And that means this power, actuality of reason, the pi ratio function, happy, positing its own individuality by the recognition that it has no alternative but to individuate, because infinity, that is the supreme Godhead, is pressing on him and driving him to individuation, and there is no escape. When and not before we realize that there is no escape, absolutely no escape whatever, then we say, time to learn the rules. What are the rules? Now this point of the deepest darkness, this 21st of December, this point of the deepest darkness is the only point at which initiation begins. The driving of those infinite powers posit here in the center a point. That is the jot that Jesus refers to. So that is in the Hebrew a letter Yod, a letter which signifies a point. And until you're nailed on that point, you cannot turn round. You cannot say back to the infinite until you've been hammered down to that point. Less than that hard point, you are fluid seeking pleasure. Pleasure defined as dependence on an external object. But if you say, I see the truth, this kind of seeing is not like that of the gross physical eyes that sees external form shapes. It's another kind of seeing. It's a magical seeing in which you see internally the truth of a proposition that all external pursuits of pleasure through external objective stimulation are utterly vain and can never produce for you that which you truly seek. The ultimate goal of all beings in Sanskrit is ananda, it is bliss. That ananda, bliss, means that the serpent is able to move freely at will and perform its own definitions from within itself and project its world, so that in no sense is it dependent on any external being or object or event for its pleasures. When we realize the mysterious meaning of harpy, that this hierarchical power activity posits the individual, and the individual then accepts this, that we are self-determined, that the infinite absolute is the supreme self pressing in and publishing and making individuals, and as it would say in the Quran, whether you like it or not, you are being individuated. You can wriggle, you can avoid it for a time, for a time, for a time. But all the time you're avoiding it, you're suffering more and more and more negations and being driven down to your 21st day of your December. Translate December as descender. We know that December is named after the December or 10th. But there it is, right down. Tenere means to hold. You hang on to your egotism as long as you can. You pursue pleasure as long as you can. And it is the infinite that is making you pursue the pleasure to teach you a lesson that pleasure is no good. But when you are having pleasure, it feels fine. But if it's externally dependent upon an object which can be removed or broken, it is not fine. It's not fine at all. Fine means end life. F-I-N-E. It means the end of life, and the end of life is an absolute, pure, spiritual self-determination. When you realize that, you become a candidate for initiation. And you say, a little piece of light, you hate all. Let there be light. I see that I cannot win. Now show me how I can win. And the answer is, don't be dependent on external objects. Give external objects as much of your attention as you care to will to give, but not pendently. Give them like you give water to a plant you're trying to grow, or a horse you want to keep alive, you feed it and groom it. Give attention, but require nothing back from it. When you do that, suddenly, in that very darkest day, you know with absolute surety you can resurrect, you can re-erect yourself. You've been driven down into your settling, compressed state of black melancholy, and in the middle of it, in your greatest despair, suddenly you realize, that's weird, I'm a despairing being. Now how can I be a despairing being unless there's a disparity in me? Despair means consciousness of disparity. And what is this mysterious disparity? This is the disparity between being a point located in space and an infinity of power intelligence which precipitated the point. This is the disparity that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt through our personal memory of our original source, which fascinated Socrates and Plato. We have a memory of all the processes of the human evolution, and we remember our divinity. And yet, mysteriously, we are totally identified with our profound stupidity and egotism. And yet, we know we are infinitely divine intelligences, and we act as if we are not infinitely divine intelligences, but that we are finitely humanoid stupidities. And these two together are our original disparity. Well, a little bit of hard pie thinking there. It says P-I, it was the power, the P, the positive, the I, the individual. There's a disparity, P and I. There is no word that we can utter that is not polarized in that way. And then we say, I must be self-imposed upon. Now, how do I get out of it? And the answer is by initiation. Now, initiation does not mean final enlightenment. It means the beginning of enlightenment. Adeptship is a much higher stage up the ladder. Initiation starts in your solar plexus, noticing in the sun. You get a feeling in your solar plexus when you make a mistake of depression, do you not? Have you noticed a sinking feeling when something goes wrong? That sinking feeling is universal in the human race and also in the animal world. Because that solar plexus is a very, very, very subtle brain. And it's much older than this forebrain. And that subtle solar brain in there remembers its divinity, remembers its solar origin. It remembers that it's fundamentally, unalterably spirit. And that the rock of ages is the true sense of individuated hierarchy inside one's being. And at that begins the initiation. And then, what do I want? I want light. I want enlightenment. Now, the word light is interesting. The word light says, bind yourself to the efforts to establish the hierarchy within yourself and accept the fact of crucifixion. That is L-I, that means bind to individual, T-H is one letter, pronounced O. They've given up pronouncing it like that because it's uncivilized, but they used to do a long time ago. Let there be loved. That's a better word, isn't it? Yeah. But it sounds coarse, almost Anglo-Saxon. But when you're prepared to say, only by personal self-effort of myself, having stepped onto the path of initiation, do I know that it's only by my personal effort, working on me internally, by my own internal effort with a hard gamma, that G, ga, and a hierarchical ugh, with it, G-H, crucify myself on this concept that I am divine in my origin, and all I need to do for the rest of my life is remember it and bring it into operation every day. It is said about eating food. Ordinary people eat food to make their bodies work and to get the energy to go to the opera and to have fine time with lady friends. But enlightened yogis do not eat food. They won't utter that word that means food. They will utter prasada. They will eat prasada. Why are you calling it prasada, not food? Well, because to me, prasada. Now, it's a magical word. It means when you pi ratio your functions, every one of them, all the material world that was gripped on that 21st day in the winter, the whole material world in its gross solidity suddenly is seen to be spiritual. And that prasada means it's spiritual. You thought you were eating donuts and smoked cheese. You're eating spirit. Do you know it? There is not a single particle of food that we eat that is not a precipitate of solar energy. There is not a sun in the sky or a star in the sky, which is a local sun over there. There is not one of those that is not a precipitate of the infinite spirit. When you know that, then it is a spiritual act to shake hands with a gross bodied millionaire. It's actually possible to have an intelligent conversation with Paul Getty in a spiritualized sense, instead of gross misrepresentation. Now, how does it feel if, in fact, at that very, very darkest time, sitting in the middle of our own being and despairing, when we suddenly think, what's all this disparity about? To despair, I must have an ideal, and I must fall short of it. Is that not true? Despair is disparity, and unless I have an ideal and fall short, I cannot despair. If I have an ideal which I realize, I do not despair. If I have no ideal, I do not despair. The animal doesn't have an ideal and does not despair. But a human being has an ideal, and despairs. Therefore, he has a disparity. Therefore, logically, in the middle of that disparity, you can say, because I have a disparity between ideal and falling short, therefore, I must be divine. I must be divine. I must be a divided being. I'm at war with myself. Why? Because I remember my anamnesis. I remember backwards the time originally sourced in infinite spirit. That spirit has come down, precipitated this body. And this is true for every one of us, whether we like it or not. The part of us that stupidly quarrels and fights, falls out and disagrees, especially just before Christmas time, that part is the grossest, most ignorant part of unenlightened matter. But the part of us that becomes aware of the significance of disparity as a proof of an ideal and the falling away from it, that is enlightenment's beginning. That's number one step. So then you say, I need light. In German, you ask for Licht. And I-C-H in German means I. And the L means to conjoin, and the T at the end means crucifixion. Let myself be crucified on this primordial, unavoidable, dialectical fact that infinity has precipitated me and I've got to get back to infinity. But I've got to get back to infinity without leaving my body, because the infinite precipitated my body as a reference point. First in the gross material world, to make sure that I couldn't get away from the lesson. Next, in the genitally sensitive pleasure world, to make sure I don't want to get away from the body. Then, in the commercial world, that makes it good business to be tied in the body. Then in the joy world of recognizing that it's even good business in enjoying yourself. And then you converge onto your solar plexus, you become aware, I need more light. And at that point, the sun begins to come up. It starts moving from the 21st to the 25th. And on that day, it is the duty, and duty means shadow, of love, and it's the loving act of any intelligent human being that on that day he goes out, like Zarathustra, to the sun, and he looks and says, you've started to rise again, and so have I. And if you do that on the 25th of December, you are joining in that very ancient ritual of the original priest-kings. And you then join the fact that you have been crucified, that you've had a very bad time in your personal winter, that you've been driven down to your sources, and now it's time for your springing up, your resurrection. With that thought, I will leave you. Thank you.